Welcome to Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our international Innovate podcast series, giving voice to socially conscious and forward-thinking leaders and organizations within the nonprofit, education, culture, philanthropy, and social entrepreneurship sectors. Here's your host, Robert Rim.
The fashion industry has seen spectacular growth in the early 21st century. It is now valued at more than $2.5 trillion annually and employs over 75 million people worldwide. Consumers are buying 60% more garments than they were 15 years ago and keeping them for half as long. Welcome to the age of fast fashion. But this success comes at a steep price. The 2018 Global Climate Action Summit concluded that, quote, from raw materials to consumer behavior, fashion has a huge carbon footprint, contributing up to 10% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. Our guest today is a leader who's made it her life's mission to clean up Earth's fashion industry. We'll talk with Sophia Minnie, an award-winning social entrepreneur and environmental activist, who's deeply concerned with all of the issues relating to ethical fashion, fair trade, sustainable production, workers' conditions, and animal welfare. She's internationally known for the company she founded in 1991, Peopletree, and the pioneer of sustainable fashion and ethically sourced garments. She led the business as global CEO for more than 20 years in Japan and the UK, and the World Economic Forum recognized her as an outstanding social entrepreneur and a leading influencer in sustainability, anti-modern slavery, and fair trade. The author of 9 books, Sophia set up her consulting business to promote leadership for sustainable business, responsible supply chains, and positive climate action. Sophia, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Great to meet you, Robert.
You're the founder of Peopletree, as I mentioned, and you've been recognized as an outstanding social entrepreneur by the World Economic Forum. You campaign on behalf of fair trade and ethical fashion. Tell us about the origins of your career and how you developed an interest in social entrepreneurship.
Yeah, thanks. I think very much it was a start as an ethical consumer. I didn't want to spend any of my money and my energy and time on products that are actually making the world a less good place, on products that are polluting the environment or are treating their workers in an exploitative way. And so my background in publishing and advertising actually came in very, very usefully. When I started Peopletree in Japan at the age of 25, 26, you know, I was kind of coming at a completely new foreign environment. I taught myself Japanese and I worked with some brilliant Japanese friends to really understand how I could find products that were fair trade, that were sustainable, that were upcycled, that were vegetarian or vegan. And this kind of information gradually came together, but we realized that without actually offering people the alternatives, it was very difficult for them to really fully immerse themselves in a sustainable lifestyle.
And you mentioned Japan, and I love it that you taught yourself Japanese.
Well, actually, I went to college to learn Japanese for a year and a half. Yes.
But in the course of learning the language, you learn as a natural result of that, you learn so much about the culture, don't you?
Absolutely. I had the joy of working at the first body shop that was based in Japan. So I was meeting lots of Japanese people, similar age to myself, all of them really motivated by ethical issues, whether it was human rights or animal rights issues or, you know, the provenance of natural ingredients. And so I think, you know, that total immersion and wanting to use Japanese language very much as a vehicle to doing my work in terms of campaigning at that stage, but then later on in building a company that would provide a lot of the solutions, great products that ticked the box and went beyond actually in terms of both fair trade and environmental issues.
And when you're talking about the fashion industry, people need to realize that including the production of all clothes that people wear, it contributes to around 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions due to its long supply chains and energy-intensive production. It also consumes more energy than the aviation and shipping industries combined, which is an enormous differentiation there. So when and how did you come to understand how deeply the fashion industry impacts our global climate?
Well, I think to start with, what was shocking to me even in the early 90s was how we were absolutely disregarding the people that make the clothes and the environment. And that's a very, very interesting stat that you have there, because in the next 20 years, we're looking at the total of carbon emissions perhaps doubling to as much as 20 to 25% of total carbon emissions. So clearly, fashion is second to the oil business, is the largest polluter. And at the same time, fashion is also this incredibly joyful expression and cultural expression. So I think for me, developing the ranges within PeopleTree, it was about how can we make fashion in a way that truly empowers and supports the artisans, the organic cotton farmers, the tailors. And if we were to use, for example, hand weaving skills and hand knitting and hand embroidery skills, we were the first company to achieve the global organic textile standards from field right the way through ginning and spinning, fabric production, printing, right through to manufacture and shipping. So how could we do fashion in a way that had the highest social impact but the lowest environmental impact? And the truth is that, you know, if we look at, for example, economic issues, justice, poverty, we have more than 70% of the rural poor that could be uplifted through fashion if it were done in a different way. And I think for many of us within the slow fashion, the fair trade, sustainable fashion movement, what we're looking at doing is really unpacking that. How can we make fashion work for the poorest of the poor, paying fair wages, bringing beautiful products to consumers, highly exquisite, unique, embellished product at a very, very low environmental cost.
And you mentioned fashion as joyful cultural impressions. And when many think of fashion, runways and wildly creative clothing come to mind. But that's really a tiny piece of the fashion industry, as it's about workers' exploitation and working conditions, as you mentioned, the drain on our environment, and even animal welfare. Since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the clothing manufacturing business has been fraught with examples of really horrific working conditions and accidents. And you've developed an intimate knowledge of these aspects of the industry. And as we've been talking about, you've been a leader in the fight for these workers. How do you work to change their specific conditions?
That's a complicated question. But I think, firstly, what I'm seeing is the fashion, large fashion brands are doing what we started out to do at PeopleTree and have evolved over these last 20 years. So they're mapping supply chains, with PeopleTree knowing absolutely everything about where the fiber is created, how the buttons are made, which material they're made with. So really understanding exactly, you know, where every part of the materials are coming from and who they're being made by. So really looking at the wages, looking at health and safety within those factories or workplaces or the farms where the materials are being made, that's really critical. And that comes with transparency. I think it really is about taking a long-term view on partnerships. So PeopleTree has suppliers that we've worked with for 20 years. We have long-term capacity building and training programs so that suppliers, even if they're based in a village, really understand, you know, how their customers are wearing their products, how their product is merchandised in stores, you know, how it's distributed. And that knowledge is so very, very important to those fair trade groups. So I think if we look over, you know, the last 10 years, as you quite rightly say, we have had some shocking examples of negligence in terms of health and safety, notably next week, the sixth anniversary of the horrible and tragic incident where more than 1,000 people died at the Rana Plaza building collapse in Dhaka in Bangladesh, which drew the whole industry's view to really understanding that we had a huge issue. And obviously it's shocking that it took brands as long as it did to admit their part in it and to pay compensation to all of the thousands injured and who lost their lives in the accident. But I think what it has done is it's galvanized now through many of the initiatives. The Accord is one in Bangladesh, which has really helped to mainstream better health and safety practice within Bangladesh. Sadly, it's not gone far enough. So we still have other developing countries where an equivalent in terms of health and safety isn't in place. And if we look at the wages that workers are being paid in Bangladesh, those wages really haven't gone up if you look at the prices that buyers are paying over the last couple of years. And the delivery times are still as fast, and the expectation is as fast as it was before. So whilst there have been some improvements due to this awful loss of life, we are still in a place where we need more government regulation to force companies to do what they say they will do. It's no longer acceptable to have a CSR policy or a CSR report. We need long-term planning to truly deliver human rights and sustainability through supply chains.
And has the accident moved others, in your experience, to commit really strongly to match your goals for social justice for this population?
I think it's begun to move the dial in the debate. What's been critical is the public engagement. So most of us buy clothing. And if we look at, for example, Fashion Revolution Week, last year there were more than 700 million people that engaged with Fashion Revolution. So there is this huge call for transparency of supply chains and better worker rights. And I think now, after the IPCC report and the knowledge that we're really facing a climate catastrophe, where we have to really look at changing the way, you know, we live, the way business operates, but also, you know, government's engagement in delivering carbon cuts, I think there's another huge pressure now from people who buy clothing, who are saying, okay, well, you know, what exactly are you doing to cut carbon emissions here? How is this sustainable? And I think, you know, if you look at what's happening in London at the moment with the, well, globally, actually, with the youth climate strikes, also with Extinction Rebellion, you know, you can just see that there's a very, very huge public appetite to put pressure on business and government to actually to reform and to change the system.
And now, a word from Arch Street Press. Still the Promised Land by Natwar Gandhi. Natwar Gandhi began life in a dusty Indian village that had no paved streets, no electricity, no telephone, and no running water. When he was 17, his father put him on a train to Mumbai in hopes that he might find work and send money home to help support the family. In Mumbai, he barely made a living, but through countless long days of work, relentless determination, and good luck, he was able to take a plane to New York at the age of 25, where he landed with $7 in his pocket. Still, the Promised Land is the fascinating and deeply personal story of how an impoverished immigrant made his way to the New World, remade his life, and ultimately became the chief financial officer of Washington, D.C., playing a key role in transforming the nation's capital from a near-bankrupt municipality into a financially healthy major American city. Gandhi's life is both cautionary and instructive, difficult yet uplifting. Ultimately, it is a harrowing and inspiring account of how to survive seemingly hopeless circumstances and succeed in America. His journey has an uplifting message for present-day America, where immigrants are often reviled and immigration itself is denigrated. It reaffirms faith in the United States' future as a great nation. Indeed, it puts forth that the 21st century will be an American century that embraces all cultures. Still the Promised Land. We now return to Sophia and Robert.
Raising awareness with consumers and within the industry is such an important initiative. How do you go about refocusing the consumer's attraction to certain brands and articles of clothing to more sustainably produced items?
I think it's multifold, and I'm really excited that there are so many different initiatives out there, you know, from apps that are aggregating the best ethical brands to investment that is now going through the environment, social and governance accreditation and filters that are calling now for businesses to really deliver the sustainable development goals, which include obviously human rights, through what they're doing in their day-to-day operations. We have certifications from Global Organic Textile Standard, World Fair Trade Organization, many other initiatives in terms of papers and packaging and biodegradable plastics or alternatives to plastics. I think there are no shortage, actually, of solutions. What is difficult is for a customer who's, you know, out shopping at the weekend to quickly find an accessible way of understanding, is this brand doing their job well? Is that brand doing their job well? I think the messaging actually is very, very complicated. I think many of us, certainly here in the UK, feel that the government needs to be taking a much, much stronger role in setting leadership. So if I can give you an example, we have the Modern Slavery Act of the end of 2015, a bit like your California Transparency Act. And we know that there are approximately 17,000 companies of £36 million turnover a year or more that have to publish a modern slavery report on their website. But we don't have a list of those companies. And, you know, really to hold those companies accountable, we feel should be supported through the government. It's too much to ask a consumer to do all of that research for themselves. It's also too much to expect ethical and fair trade and sustainable brands, whether they be fashion or renewable energy, to be competing on an unlevel playing field with companies that are, frankly, just on this race to the bottom. So I do feel it's a very complicated environment for people who are out there trying to navigate and deliver on a sustainable lifestyle. And we need the government to really act.
Yet despite those initiatives and solutions out there that you mentioned, some voices in the public sphere argue that the onus is on the industry and not the consumer to change, and that the best thing for companies and influencers to do is to look at the industry as a system. So what are your thoughts on the argument that it's the industry and not the consumer that needs to first change?
We wouldn't have the change that we have now if the consumer or the citizen had not created the movements that are really holding business accountable. Having said that, I completely agree with you. You know, one in three people in businesses are cultural creatives. They want to be working for a company that's doing the right thing. And they're very often the champions within those businesses that are delivering the change. Having said that, we need, you know, CEOs and the C-suite to be truly engaged in that mission too. I think we do need to be looking to industry and to business. And there are some really very progressive, pioneering businesses that are doing a great job. They're sharing that expertise and templates with smaller businesses. They're really sticking their neck out, working with the governments of developing nations also to bring the standards up. That's what we're seeing in terms of, for example, migrant labor in Mauritius. You know, fashion companies are engaging with the Mauritian government to be really sure that there is an environment that prevents forced labor. But I think the important thing is that they're also calling for government legislation, a framework that rewards companies for doing the right thing. Because at the moment, if you're a company doing something that quite frankly is illegal and immoral and certainly is not sustainable, there is no punishment. And I think that's really the issue.
And about bringing the standards up, as you mentioned, you'll be taking part in an important day of public action in the UK on April 17th called the Extinction Rebellion. Tell us how you got involved, what happens at the event, and what you and the other participants hope to achieve in holding it.
So I think for many of us who have worked in sustainability and human rights and environmental justice for the last 30 years, we've been talking about climate change. We've read books like Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. And we understand that scientific reports have been spiked or ignored, or you know, information has been covered up by various lobbying activism from different types of often oil company. I think there's a real opportunity now with the IPCC report, with open debate and understanding and acknowledgement that we are facing an environmental crisis, that climate change, the signals and the symptoms we're feeling, we understand what they are. There are no shortage of solutions, but there is no political will to truly drive change. And so Extinction Rebellion and the youth school strikes are very much wanting to put pressure on the government to engage with that as a topic. I think there are three things. You know, one is simply to tell the truth about climate change and about the huge environmental collapse that we are likely to see and the speed at which we're likely to see that. The second is to implement strategies that allow for us to go zero carbon by 2025. And the third is to look at a citizens' assembly that would enable us to act and to create that process by which we deliver it.
And looking ahead, Sophia, are you optimistic that governments will in fact more closely engage on these crucial subjects?
Well, without that engagement, we don't have a future as a species. So I sincerely hope they will.
And let's hope that hope translates into action, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. We're part of the fashion industry, the retail industry. We are doers. We are creatives. We're able to operate at a very sophisticated level. And we really need to realign that focus towards the huge catastrophe that we have, which is, you know, a system that is dysfunctional, GDP that is expected to grow at 3% each year, which over 20 years would mean that we had doubled it, when we're currently using nearly twice our planetary natural resources. So clearly there's a non-alignment. Actually, the emperor has no clothes on, but you know, we're all somewhat complicit in the system as it stands, the business as usual as it stands. So I think that's really the big discussion and debate that's happening at the moment in the UK and worldwide.
And in considering what you mentioned about doers, about creatives, operating at a sophisticated level, more and more women are assuming leadership roles in our world. And you set up a consulting business to promote leadership for sustainable business and responsible supply chains. I'll ask you, as a woman with rich leadership experience, what kind of qualities make women ideal leaders? And do they have a unique role to play in positions relating to ethical fashion?
There are, of course, you know, many different qualities that we share with woke men. You know, I think we're very collaborative in our approach. I think we're very good at thinking holistically, whether you call it systems thinking or holistic thinking. And I think we naturally think long term as nurturers. We think long term. These are attributes that women instinctively carry with them. I think that there are also men out there that carry this type of approach, but I think we're able to navigate, and we're able to move perhaps with less ego. So I'm very much hoping that we'll see a different approach to leadership, especially in this time when we absolutely so need different thinking, different doing, a much more empathetic, perhaps a less proud view of doing business, because we're going to have to test our theories on the run. We're going to have to evolve and innovate at an incredible speed.
And you mentioned ego. In your experience, isn't it true that when leaders put their own ego at the forefront, they become far less effective in their quote-unquote mission?
I think leadership is about service, and I think it's a very interesting time for many leaders. When I'm executive coaching, I find that leaders are generally very isolated. And, you know, we're talking at a time when, you know, there are real commercial challenges, but also there are huge challenges in terms of the issues that we've discussed in terms of sustainability, human rights, climate change. And I think being able to really unpack and work with people, their values and how they see that supporting and empowering the teams around them to make very significant strides to change. I find that that's incredibly exciting, but I am seeing a lot of change, which is very, very heartening.
It is heartening, and I'm so glad to hear that from your perspective. And Sophia, tell us what's next for you. What new projects are you working on?
Well, some of them are kind of top secret, actually.
Okay.
I can tell you my dream.
Please don't share anything top secret, but do tell us about your dreams and what you'd like to see happen going forward.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at creating a Center for Sustainability, which will bring both a set of services to citizens to empower sustainable living, at the same time a set of services to businesses that will hopefully empower them to be more sustainable and to move through this transformation at the speed and effectiveness that we need. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
And in addition to all of your achievements, you're a mother. So Sophia, how has that experience influenced your work for the social good and the environment that your children will, in fact, inherit?
My eldest, Jerome, who's 26, there are some really very interesting echoes because, you know, we've had a lot of people here in the UK in their 20s signing up to birth strike, which means that they are committing to not have children because they feel that the future is too grim and too frightening. And I remember thinking, you know, do I want children or not, a couple of years before I had them, and feeling exactly the same. And I think for me, it's what is incredibly saddening is that we've come to this point as late as we have. And now we're seeing, you know, so many people really having to make some very, very big sacrifices in terms of how they view the future. So whilst I feel that I'm doing what I can, I wish it were more. And you know, I really, you know, pray that we will do it in time, and that, you know, we all have a role to play. And I think that's what's really encouraging, you know, whether you're a doctor or a taxi driver or a teacher or a fashion designer or an entrepreneur or an operations director. You know, we all have our way of delivering in terms of sustainability and transforming what we do and how we live. So, I'm just doing my bit.
Mm. And we certainly all have a role to play in sustainability, in human rights, in climate change. And on these vital notes, listeners can find out more online at sophia-mini.com and on social media. Sophia, all the best as you continue your crucial work that impacts so many people.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Innovate is produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, this has been Innovate.